Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Aslaf Romorowski, and I'd like to welcome you to the SPME, another edition of the SPME BDS Monitor Conference Calls. This afternoon, we have a great privilege to have an actual panel, which I will be a part of, as well as the moderator for this afternoon's call, for a new volume that myself and my two colleagues, Donna Robinson Devine and Miriam Elman, have put together that is coming out shortly. The title of our upcoming volume is called Word Crimes, Reclaiming the Language of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. It is a volume that we've been working on for the past year or so that will be coming out as a special edition in the upcoming Israel Studies Journal. And then later on will be published in as a series, as a volume. Just to go over a few housekeeping issues as far as the format. Those of you who have been with us in the past know the format, but for those of you who have never been with us, I'd like to just go over the housekeeping issues and, of course, introduce our speakers, and we can go from there. Those of you who are logged in through the computer, you will see a icon of a hand. Should you have a question, and of course we welcome as many questions as possible that we can take today, please click on that hand icon and I will be able to unmute you and you can ask your questions. I ask, of course, as always, that you have a question, not a statement, just for time's sake, and you will be able to ask either one of our panelists your question. You also have the opportunity, if you do not wish to personally ask a question, to write a question via the system and send it through email, and I'll be able to read your question. If there are questions after the call, as always, we have our own personal email address, bdsmonitor@spme.org. Again, bdsmonitor@spme.org. You can send us questions after today's call, should you have questions later on. That, again, is the format, which I will, again, repeat when we get to the Q&A. But let me go on to introduce our speakers this afternoon, and we can start our conversation. We will talk for about a half hour, 35 minutes or so, and then we will open up a call for as many questions as we have. Our first speaker, and I must say that I'm here amongst friends and colleagues, is my friend and colleague, Donna Robinson Devine. Donna is current president of the Association for Israel Studies. Has been a professor of political science at Smith College her entire career, a prolific writer and speaker on many of the issues that we're dealing with today. She's also a board member of SPME. Next will be Miriam Elman, who is, again, another friend and colleague, another prolific writer and speaker, and now the current incoming executive director of the Academic Engagement Network. She has been a professor of political science. All of us came together about a year or so ago, given the reality that we're seeing on the ground and in the academy regarding the fallacies of BDS to try to tackle the problems that we're seeing. And this is really how this volume came about. So without further ado, I will let Donna start first. Then Miriam, and then I will chime in with questions and in between all of this. And of course, we welcome your questions after we're done talking. So, Donna, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Asaf. I thought I'd start with an anecdote that illustrates why I and others thought there was a need for this volume. A few years ago at the conference of the American Historical Association, I went to a session that was focused on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And one of the scholars there, Shira Robinson from George Washington University, spoke about an alleged cover-up that Israel was engaged in through its archives, not allowing access to to archival material about the 1948 war that would definitively prove the Israelis engaged in genocide against the Palestinians. In the aftermath of that conference, I organized a session, or tried to organize a session at the in Israel at the Association for Israel conference, bringing in the state archivist, Yaakov Lozowick, and the archivist of the military institutions to explore whether there was any legitimacy, or the extent to which there was legitimacy, and what the classification system with regard to the 1948 war, how that operated. And Yaakov Lozowick and the military archivist agreed to participate. Then I went back to Shira Robinson, who said, no, she participated in the boycott of Israel and refused to come to Israel to participate, even though it would presumably have given her access to the information she said existed that would sort of prove her case. This illustrates, I think, why the academic study of the Israel-Palestine conflict has been so degraded. Instead of looking carefully at all the circumstances and the contours, this is a conflict that has lasted for longer than the state of Israel, much longer than the state of Israel has existed, and has taken many different forms. It is not the same conflict it was in the late 19th century at the beginning of the Zionist movement, nor is it the same conflict that existed in 48, nor even in 67. And it's a conflict that whose contours change and needs to be studied, as fully as possible. The boycott movement is an attempt to keep people from the facts and from the information and from the entire context. And it does so by deploying a series of words that started on campuses and in courses, but has really traveled beyond the campus to mainstream media of all sorts. And it's the speed with which it has traveled has increased exponentially through social media. So of all the changes that can be documented in the history of Zionism, and in particularly in the 70 years since the founding of Israel, nothing is as dramatic and surprising as the country's status, Israel's status as a topic of intellectual inquiry. Once it was a trope for self-sacrifice, solidarity. Now it stands accused of practicing apartheid, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and sustaining itself, created by an outdated, thoroughly delegitimized colonial order. So what we decided to do was to interrogate those terms and to see and investigate the extent to which those terms are used credibly in the way the language of the Israeli-Palestine conflict has evolved, and to see to what extent those words are really hiding or distorting the actual history of the conflict. We gathered together a number of people. I think there are probably about 17 or 18. Miriam probably has the exact numbers. We looked at the terms, the hot button terms, apartheid, occupation, Zionism, which instead of becoming a term that explains how a group of Jews established a Jewish state in the Middle East, has become a term of abuse and judgment and totally distorted. We look very carefully at colonialism, indigeneity, the refugee, genocide, pinkwashing, intersectionality, whether there was really, to the extent to which organizations and associations that claim the status of civil society really are part of a civil society as understood by the people who developed that term. And we think it's important to reclaim the language, because the language itself has become a tool for judging and distorting the nature of, judging Israel, distorting the nature of the conflict, and not fully understanding what's going on. The people we gathered, I assume, have all sorts of different political views about the topic. They were never asked. We just gathered people who we thought had written with insight or could write with insight about particular topics. So our objective was to reclaim the academic standards and academic integrity for the study of the Palestine-Israel conflict, not to make any particular judgments about who's right and who's wrong in the contours of the conflict itself. So let me say that by way of introduction. We stand for trying to gather as much information as possible to provide as deep an understanding of this issue as possible, because that's what we feel our mission as academicians should be. So I'll let Miriam continue.
Thanks, Donna. That's a great explanation. I think we all have these reasons why we decided to do this book, and why we want to expose the crimes of language and the shoddy pseudo-scholarship that, you know, is getting awards and winning prizes in various fields. I mean, I think, you know, part of the reason that we thought this is really important to do this volume is because we need a corrective, right? So the anti-Zionist paradigm has gained such a strong foothold in academia. Of course, it fits nicely with the general trend in academics these days to virtue signal, to view the world in terms of absolute good and absolute evil, which really, you know, exacerbates this false sense of truth. And we think that the project as a whole and all the chapters taken together, that as Donna said, you know, interrogate the words, the history, the meaning of the words, and how they are perverted and misused and misapplied today. And we think that our project will serve as a corrective. So it'll provide an alternative perspective to thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you know, as Donna's been mentioning, what we see is, in place of rigorous scholarship that would include field and archival work, which Shira Robinson didn't want to do, right? In place of the actual research and scholarship, we have buzzwords and catchphrases, apartheid, settler colonialism, pinkwashing, and, you know, entire disciplines, whether it's Middle Eastern studies, women and gender studies, ethnic studies, they now rely on these code words that are wielded by scholar activists, the vast majority of whom don't know Hebrew, haven't spent any time, if at all, in Israel. And so you have this sort of perversion of the standards of evidence, along with open inquiry, because, you know, they want to boycott, and they endorse PAC-B and the academic boycott of Israel. So you get now this sort of distortion of these crucial terms. Is so pervasive, we can't even remember or recall the way the terms were initially used. So that's what we mean by reclaiming the language, and that's how we approached each of the scholars. We asked them to consider the term the way it was used you know, decades ago in the scholarship, and how it has morphed and transformed, and many of these words have become weaponized. And so, you know, I think the book isn't just normatively desirable for better knowledge production. We think it also promises to promote greater understanding and tolerance. So at a time when, you know, the debate over anti-Semitism has become so polarized that we have a difficult time distinguishing racism from legitimate criticism of Israeli policy. I mean, what could be more important than improving the discourse? It needs to be our prime concern.
Thank you.
So, Assaf, off to you.
Yeah.
Well, again, I don't disagree with any of my colleagues here on the phone. I think that you know, again, to continue the politicization, and I think that the current political toxicity that we're seeing today in North America and in Europe has also, you know, to Miriam's point, has weaponized many of these terms, and really has highlighted the disingenuous understanding for, you know, for all of us in the social scientists who basically worked hard to focus on inquisitive research and to try to seek out the facts and truth on these issues. The entire academy, as we know, has been hijacked by these terms. Not to mention the fact that the political toxicity that we're seeing today, I would say globally, and even in Israel, has emboldened the BDS narrative that we see to be extremely problematic at large and disingenuous to actual research in general. I think Donna's point and Donna's illustration of the fact that even when you show people facts, they refuse to accept them given the sources. Again, the fact that nothing Israel can do or nothing that comes out of the state of Israel, Israeli archives, can be seen as legitimate scholarship, but, you know, has to be seen within the prism of the facts or so-called facts by the Palestinianization and the propaganda is very telling. I think historically speaking, but all of us know, Donna and Miriam, that, you know, there was a point in time where even, you know, especially within the area of people who were dealing with the Middle East, there was actual honest unearthing of facts. And you could trace it back, I would say, historically back to even up until the mid-90s, you could see individuals, even if they weren't ardent Zionists, they at least presented both sides of the story. There's no doubt that over the years and even prior to the 1990s, the factor of Edward Said, of course, led a whole other dimension to how Middle East studies and how these topics have been taught to this very day. But now the tactic, as many of us know, has been not to have discourse or debate or inquisitive research, but actually shut down conversation. And so, you know, part of the interesting part about our project, I think that all of us agree that for the past few months, we have presented this project at the Association of Israel Studies, at the Association of Middle East Studies in Africa. And what we're finding is, and which is really, I think, our hope for the volume at large, we're seeing so many scholars come out saying, this is what is needed. It's missing from the conversation, and we wish we had more of that. So we do hope that that is a good indicator that maybe can change at least some of the discourse on these issues, given the hostility and polarization that we're facing.
Perhaps I could give two examples,
sure.
Two concrete examples just briefly about what our volume is trying to do and why we think it responds to the degradation of language. Let's take Zionism, for example. And we know in the past several decades, from the Zionism as racism resolution at the UN and the way in which Zionism is equated with a kind of racism, that in that there's a sense in which even among many mainstream journalists that Zionism historically meant that the Jews wanted to establish a Jewish state and eliminate the Arab population there, when in fact it distorts the way in which the Zionists viewed the Arabs. Zionism was a movement to restructure Judaism rather than to restructure the Arab population of Palestine. There was a kind of historical romanticism of the Arab population in Palestine. And in fact, even the notions of sovereignty embedded in the classical Zionist theoreticians, and that would include Jabotinsky, had notions of giving minority populations or non-Jewish populations extraordinary autonomy, cultural autonomy, not aiming at doing anything to harm the cultural differences of the population in the region. So there was, you can see that this, if people actually read the essays in detail of Jabotinsky and compared them with Herzl and Ahad Ha'am and all the founders. Similarly, the notion of colonialism, when the Ottoman Empire was defeated in World War I, it was not only the Zionists who sought successfully some backing from the great power, but you had the Arabs in Palestine, to the extent that they were organized in Muslim Christian associations, approach the French or ask for or send lobbyists to London to try to get great power backing for their own positions. So no one ignored the colonial power. People in the region felt they needed it to restructure their own politics.
And if I can add to Donna's point about how useful these chapters are in, you know, going through the way the terms were used and how we can reclaim this language in a way to be more historically honest. And I think that's helpful for students. I think it's helpful for scholars. If you think of any of the number of terms in our project, occupation, apartheid, settler colonialism, indigeneity, you know, many of them are legal, historical concepts. They had precise meanings at certain points in time, which we don't remember anymore. And now they're being sort of misapplied, and it's really perverting the way these terms were used in the past by scholars. So, you know, just to pick up on the point, colonialism, it's an essay by John Strawson, and he really nicely goes through how colonialism was used as a term in 1940s and the scholarship of the 1940s, where, you know, Israel is seen as a state that's creating a blow against imperialism, right? And so, right. You know, if you lose that and you don't and you sort of bury it because it doesn't fit with the anti-Israel, anti-Zionist narrative, then you're sort of distorting knowledge of the history. I think if you go through each of these chapters, each of these essays, you get these nuggets of information that are sidelined in much of the current discourse. So to give another example, a chapter by Ilan and Carol Troen on indigeneity, which kind of looks at one point at how Bedouin settlements today are being labeled illegal, right? But actually, and this is something they describe in the chapter, the Bedouins themselves don't label their communities as illegal. They label them as unrecognized. So that's the term that's used by the Bedouins and their supporters to be quite critical of the Israeli state and to argue for, you know, the intransigence and the disregard. It's, you know, they've been quite critical, but they're using a different term. The narrative, the anti-Israel narrative, doesn't want anybody to know that that's a term that's being used because it doesn't fit right with the villainization of Israel to show that, you know, these Bedouin communities are unrecognized in the same way that you might have unrecognized spaces in other countries, that Israel isn't uniquely villainous, right? It's just so that's part of what the book is trying to do, is provide the facts that are missing in the dominant narratives that we have out there in so many different disciplines.
Right. I mean, and this, to add, you know, and to add one more point, you know, to, you know, to the points that were raised here, the other facet, of course, which we also highlight, of course, is the entire industry of human rights and the money behind the NGOs who claim to be so-called advocates for human rights that have created a kind of a cottage industry. If you look at individuals like Richard Falk and others who have basically politicized the academy with a very distinct narrative, even though the facts prove otherwise. But, you know, we have tracked, you know, in some of our chapters, I believe Jerry Steinberg's chapter, as well as Alex Jaffe's chapter on human rights, really shows how disingenuous even they are. But, of course, we all know that the idea, the concept of human rights all sounds very utopian, non-politicized. Clearly, there's a clear political agenda that we see has been used and abused by the architects of this narrative. And we also know that if you go into the funders of peace and studies, the discipline here in the States, are also involved in funding of BDS activity, going back to the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers, and others. And so part of that is also showing, where the money has bought the politicization and where the money has bought the education, which, again, of course, we all know and have experienced in some way or another, the buying of the academy, the degradation of the academy, where, of course, it's replaced any kind of real fact. And so I think that's another facet that we hope will unearth and bring light to the issues for stakeholders and others to know what is happening today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I mean, so we all believe that these are, you know, obviously, you know, very critical issues. And I think it's about 12:28 now, and I know there are a lot of people on the call. So with that being said, I mean, and of course, Donna and Miriam, we could add more as we go along, but let's start by opening the floor to some questions and see, you know, if we can tackle some of the, you know, the big issues going forward. So just to go over the housekeeping issues for those of you who've joined us while we were talking. If you are on the phone, if you are logged on the computer, you can raise your hand, so to speak, and I will be able to unmute you and you can ask your question. And you could also email us a question through the system currently or email us a question later. But the floor is now open, and I do encourage individual to please ask as many questions as they have. We have one question here that I see that I will read. Ah, okay. So there are some questions that have been logged on, and so let me read them. Donna Miriam, you can take it as we go along. The first question is by Linda Lanceman, and my question is a practical application. How can these chapters be used to counter the political actions taken by those who have distorted the terms and are using the distorted terms in their for political reasons? That's question one.
Well, yeah. I mean, these the volume, the Israel Studies volume as a journal will be available soon, within the next couple of months. And certainly, if you're members of the Association for Israel Studies, or you have access to the journal, or you have a subscription, or through a library that receives it, and you can gain access to the journal, to its individual articles, and those of us who edited the volume are available for questions, you know, comments, feedback, anything that we can do. These can be assigned in classes.
Correct.
Right. We actually specifically told our authors, who are all, you know, scholars and academics, junior, senior, and they're from the U.S., from the U.K., from Israel. And, you know, we told them that, first of all, the chapters are between 4,000 to 5,000 words, so they're very accessible. You know, they're, but we and they're footnoted, they're sourced, we believe in sources. But we told the authors that we wanted the papers to be understood by the uninitiated. So, you know, we want them to be accessible for students and for the public, as well as for scholars. And they really are written in that vein. The book is coming out in paperback, so it will be affordable. And we're also planning, I know at the Academic Engagement Network, we're planning to do some multimedia on the volume, so to have some videos of the authors presenting, and those can also be useful for students and in various campaigns that and they're trying to combat anti-Israel and BDS on the campuses. So in a way, you know, the book can be used for students who don't have a course that is balanced and that is historically accurate and true to the facts. They can pick up this book and they can educate themselves.
The other thing is we will try, once it comes out as a paperback, to get it reviewed.
Yep.
Right. And SPME too, we'll in conjunction with all of us, we'll get it out, you know, we'll as far as getting out volumes, as many as we can, and to try to get also by our colleagues and everybody here, you know, who teaches, to use the book and to assign the book. You know, and also hope to get some media for it going forward, as far as talking about the need for this. So, you know, we're all going to try to maximize, you know, all the outlets we have to make that happen.
Right. And I think we've agreed to do a book tour, right? Asaf and Donna will do something when the book is out.
Yes.
And do a traveling tour.
We'll go anywhere and everywhere. we're invited, as long as we're not put down, to talk about these issues, gladly. I mean, that I think is
right.
Part of our goal, you know, going forward. Let me read a few more questions so we can also address some of these questions. So Charles has a question. Charles Isman, sorry if I botched your name. The question that Charles has is about social justice. Is that another term that's been co-opted by anti-Israel academics as part of the propaganda campaign? Clearly it has, but I think Charles is wanting to know if how we tackle that in our volume.
I missed the term.
Social justice.
Could you repeat it as a
social
justice? Oh yeah. Okay. Well, one of the ways we address the social, the so-called social justice issue is through the chapter on intersectionality, and also in the introduction where Israel has been condemned by false analogy. So there's been an attempt to wrap the notion of racism as understood in the context of African-American history and civil rights and transpose that into the Middle East. So the conflict, the more recent conflict and confrontation along the Gaza Strip has been used in rap music and in essays by activists to say that what's happening in Gaza is the same thing that happens to African Americans who are the subject of racism, the targets of racism, who are shot illegally by police, to wrap that together. And what we have tried to do, and what I in particular have tried to do, is to say that when you use analogies, I mean, I'm a comparative political scientist, I use analogies all the time. When you use analogies, you have to use them analytically. You have to be careful that your categories are comparable. And not everyone who is perceived to be oppressed is oppressed in the same way, for the same reason, is in the same set of circumstances. What the issue in the United States with African Americans is far different from a conflict between Palestinians and Israelis over land, over state, over what is perceived justice by the Palestinians. And what happens in the case of the Israel-Palestine conflict is the notion that justice can that justice has to be meted out to the Palestinians by Israel, not that an agreement between two sovereign people, two national peoples who want sovereignty and have claims to the same land, how they have to negotiate and resolve the multi-layered conflict that has gone on. That's not, they don't live with claims to the same constitution, to the same country. They're not living within the same country the way African Americans are living in America. So social justice, if the criterion were what will benefit most people, what solution to the Palestine-Israel conflict will benefit most people, the issue could be resolved. That's not the way the conflict has been cast, particularly by the Palestinians.
Great.
And to pick up on you know, Donna's points here, if you look at the dynamics on campus today, you see this situation where if you want to champion progressive causes, whether it's Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ, feminist rights, you name it, right? Then, you know, you must by definition support BDS and be anti-Israel. It's that sort of ostracism of Jews and Zionists, non-Jews, from the community of the good that I think animates us to want to do this project. And I think why we had people like Don Ellis writing on apartheid and Corinne Blackmore writing on pinkwashing, that in a sense, you know, it's become a situation where you can't admire or value anything that originates in Israel as a progressive. Like, this is what you're being told on campuses, because Israel has to be put in this box of villain par excellence. And so our view, you know, our view and what you know, Corinne and Don and others who have looked at these terms and the way that they've been manipulated in the discourse is the way in which this really just kind of shuts down, distorts, inserts biases, fallacies, and, you know, substitutes propaganda for what should be rigorous scholarship. So, you know, much of the book is an overview of the conflict. You can really understand the conflict, I think, as Donna and Asaf were mentioning. You can really understand the conflict through this book. But I think you understand a lot about BDS and the anti-Israel movement array, you know, and the global anti-Israel movement. I think you understand a lot about it as well through reading this book.
Great. Well, we have a hand raised up. Let me try to also unmute Alan here and see if he can ask his question. Alan, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. The floor is yours. Yes.
Okay. Well, my only question is, why should your book be more acceptable to those who today are trying to subvert Israel through distortions? Why are this going to be more acceptable to them? Or why aren't they just going to continue their distortions?
I mean, those aren't the people I think we're trying to convince. We know that there are certain people who are not will. This is not going to convince Angela Davis to change her mind, who, by the way, was a classmate of mine. But it may be useful to those students, to those faculty with open minds, to those students who want to learn. I still have faith, enough faith in the academy to think that there are people really want to know what's going on.
You have more faith than me, I can tell you.
Okay.
Trying to. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, let me continue on. Thank you, Alan. We're going to continue on reading some of the more questions that were sent in here. There are a few logistical questions that were asked here. The book is not on Amazon yet, and where can it be found? As we mentioned before, the book is first coming out as a special edition volume with Israel Studies, and then will come out as a volume. Once it's on Amazon or other kinds of online outlets, we will promote it and send out the link to all our many lists. But currently, you are correct, the person who asked the question, it is not on Amazon yet. But it will be, we hope it will be soon. So once it's out, we will promote that.
Right. It's an Indiana University Press book. It's coming out in the Israel Studies Perspective series at Indiana University Press, which is important. We want our volume to have that kind of credibility with the academy. And so we purposely, looked for a academic publisher, and we're really pleased that Indiana University Press will reproduce the special issue of Israel Studies into a book that, you know, can be then, you know, put on an Amazon platform and can be purchased by one and all. And that series, by the way, is absolutely terrific. So I recommend for people to go on to Indiana University Press and have a look at the other volumes that are in the Israel Studies Perspective series, all very top-notch, terrific, first-rate pieces of research.
Another question that we got, again, another pragmatic question, you know, more of a, you know, logistical issue. We have a few members here, Sonia Bloomfield, who signed on from overseas and was questioning, you know, whether the book will be translated. We hope so. We don't know yet. We haven't gotten that far. If we're going into other languages, we're first trying to get the book out in English. And then we'll talk about languages. But It would be nice if it were translated into other languages. You know, if that were the case, we'll definitely keep everybody posted. But we're not there yet. let me go to more actual content. You know, another question here by Beverly Price, who's asking word crimes, and she's asking whether or not Chomsky has been invoked, challenged in the publication. Beverly is from Johannesburg, so obviously the question of issues of apartheid are near and dear to Beverly's environment. Also, she wants to know, has the distortion and the slippage of semantics been analyzed in a particular linguistic methodology, related to the Chomsky element? So Donna, Miriam, do you want to tackle any of those questions?
We certainly haven't. We haven't used any sophisticated linguistic analysis, partly because, as Miriam said before, we wanted this accessible. Miriam's a very accomplished editor, so anything that became too jargony was smoothed out. We're aware in general of sort of the more conventional ways in which language has been written about in terms of distortion. So you'll find references to both Plato and George Orwell in the introduction. And the Don Ellis chapter on apartheid certainly looks more specifically at that.
Right. And, you know, the other thing about the volume is it is interdisciplinary. So the scholars are political scientists, historians, sociologists, anthropologists, women's studies, and a variety of others. So, there isn't one overarching theoretical perspective. And we ask scholars to be self-conscious about the scholarly underpinnings and sort of the guild rules of their disciplines as they look at the terms. That was a lot of fun to just see, the different, even the different writing styles of the different scholars. So I think it'll be a fun book to read in that, each chapter of looks a little different. There's some different kinds of argumentation and even the presentation, and we didn't want to force authors into one particular style or into one particular theoretical framework.
Great. Let me read another question here and see and go from there. Phil Cohen has a question. And of course, he agrees that there has been an intentional distortion of the truth through many of these terms because they're so embedded. It's claiming that it's difficult or impossible to uproot this honest discourse. He applauds our volume, which we thank him for that. He wants to know, given the huge anti-Israel industry that is reached into the academy at large, how do we press the ideas of the book as to have a more larger, meaningful impact? Many of us come out of the social sciences. We have, there are a lot of people that many of us know, and we are part of different associations. Our goal is to just bring another viewpoint. We never had the intention, which is what the opposition has had, of shutting down conversation, but we're actually looking for conversation to actually have real discourse. And so I think all of us believe, and I'll let my colleagues comment as well, there's an opportunity for real conversation. We're not looking to shut down debate. We're looking for an opportunity to insert another viewpoint, which we think is healthy for the academy. And that is through teaching these topics, having the book accessible, using the book, in classrooms. But again, it's, as Miriam mentioned, it's multidisciplinary. We hope that it will have impact on several disciplines who are, you know, and others by just bringing another viewpoint. And I think that that's really the way that kind of healthy balance is needed to combat that. All of you in the audience know that this is an uphill battle, but we think that having these kind of actual sources is useful going forward. I don't know if Mir.
Let me just add that I suppose there was a time when I shared the pessimism of some of that some of you expressed, but one thing sort of turned the corner for me was one of the first times we presented at the Association for Israel Studies Conference. Now, many of you may think, well, the Association for Israel Studies Conference, say, you know, you're speaking to, an audience of like-minded people. In fact, the Association for Israel Studies has a number of people who would support boycotts of Israel and who do support boycotts of Israel. And when we put together a panel for Berkeley, the last conference, where we had to beat back an attempt to get the association to boycott Israel. I was unsure of what would happen at that panel. In fact, I was talking to myself so I wouldn't be too disappointed, saying, "We'll have no one show up, or we'll have only hostile people showing up." And in fact, the room was filled, and it was filled with people who said, "My God, that's wonderful," who wanted to join the project, who expressed some reservations that we would change the discipline, but gave us a great deal of encouragement in going forward. I mean, and so it was just a pleasant surprise. And each time we've given any part of this presentation, we've had people who said that they were waiting for something like this.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean that's all true. I was there with Donna, and I think it was pleasantly surprised to see, you know, the amount of people who actually, you know, thought this to be useful. I mean that is encouraging, and you know, and I think that what is clear to all of us, I mean, I think that, you know, with the as all of us mentioned in our opening remarks, that while the hijacking of the academy or the Palestinianization or the you know, the kind of the BDS prism that has basically dominated the academy, what we're also finding on a, you know, on the flip side is that people are having a difficult time finding other sources of information, which is a symptom of the problem that we've actually have experienced all over the place from our Israeli colleagues and others, that, you know, people are having a difficult time getting published, you know, when they have more sympathetic views toward the Zionist narrative, finding data out there. And so I think that, as you know, in this age of saturation of information, you're also seeing a dearth in the academy in particular when it comes to finding other viewpoints regarding Israel, the Arab-Israeli conflict, Zionism. And so I think that, you know, what we're finding, that this is, again, to Miriam's point, why we thought it was so important for the volume to be published in an academic journal, to have to be seen as a legitimate academic resource, and as a volume as well that would reach out to a larger audience. I mean, this was part of our clear intention in order to make sure that we maximize our exposure and maximize the data. Yeah, I know, Miriam, Donna, if anything you want to say more about that, but I think we're in agreement there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to push forward. We put together this volume. It was it couldn't have been done. It's a three-legged stool, and it's standing because of the three of us, I suppose, initially. We are pleased with what we've done, and we see no reason not to talk about it.
And we hope all of you on the call will talk about it and bring it forward. I think that, this is part of what we believe is healthy. And, and obviously there's a great deal of interest in bringing out these issues. Clearly, the political environment is not easy to bring up these issues, but we think that this is needed and something we will go anywhere and everywhere to do to get this other side.
And to just add, I think it really pains me when I hear from graduate students that they're afraid to write about Israel in their dissertations or afraid to, write an article about a particular topic that they're interested in, and Israel could be a case study because they won't get a job in Middle Eastern studies or in ethnic studies or in women's and gender studies. Those fears are real. They're not made up. And we want to show students, young junior scholars, that you can do scholarship in this field, and it can be credible scholarship, and it could be scholarship that's true to sources, and you can get published in an academic journal, in the top journal in the field, and in a top university press. And in a way, it's sort of our, Donna and Asaf and I and all the authors involved, it's our answer to the BDS movement that's trying to shut down open inquiry. And our volume says, no, we're just not going to stand for that. We're going to continue to push back on that, and we're going to continue to force the propagandists that are out there, right, who are trying to distort the history, with shoddy scholarship and pseudo-research, and really kind of abusing a language to defame a people. That's the way I describe a lot of the work. If you look at Rutgers University Jasbir Puar's work, that's won awards and prizes, abusive language to defame a people, a wholesale redescription of history that's turned Jews into guilty oppressors. And I think our volume is in many ways an antidote to that kind of defamation and demonization.
Exactly. So Don Ellis is also on the call. So why don't we let Don ask his last question before we end this, so I can stick to our time. So let me, Don, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Hi, Don.
How are you doing?
Hi, Don.
How are you? I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the particular criteria you use for to make choices about what went in the volume, what chapter titles, what concepts did you think were more important, and why, and what criteria did you use to choose them?
Great question.
Good question. Thanks, Don. Miriam. Don.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Some of it was obvious because it's used. The terms are used constantly. Colonialism. Indigeneity, Holocaust, genocide, apartheid, some of the concepts. The intersectionality was new, but again, you just look at the rhetoric and the terms come screaming out to you.
Indeed. Yeah. And we wanted to give voice to people who have written on these terms, as well. So we asked people that have expertise on this language and this material through their other work. And there were specific scholars who we felt we really want these people in the volume. They're important to include. So it was sort of a multiple kind of way of thinking about what needed to be in here. We also have like a perfect magic number of 15. So it looks, there's 15 words. plus an intro, a conclusion, and then an article on civil society and the funders and enablers of the demonization of Israel. So once we got to 15, we said, okay, that's, you know, I think there could be volume two, either we do it or somebody else, but maybe there are words that are missing. We think we've captured the essential ones in the discourse, but, you know, there are others that could also be included. So hopefully this sparks more research, and, you know, more study of the language and the discourse and the way it's used.
Yeah. No, and Miriam, to your point before, I didn't want to be remiss to, you know, to mention, about the use of the book and the generations. We also have a recent graduate student that also,
right.
You know, Ari Bloff's chapter, you know, again, as far as, you know, to your point before about the fear of writing about Israel, you know, people's own experiences. We've tried to capture also to give the generational impact, so to speak, about, you know, how this phenomenon is impacting everybody, you know, who are trying to deal and tackle and study the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli conflict today. And I think that that's also, gives the fuller breadth of the challenges today. And so I think that that's also quite telling. And, we all hope that we'll lead to a 2.0. I mean, obviously the problem is not going away. And I'm sure there's much to talk about and write about, which all of us, all of us being in the weeds know also well. Given that it's 1 o'clock and I want to be conscious of people's time and effort, and so I really above all want to thank everybody for taking the time to join us this afternoon. This is clearly going to be an ongoing conversation, we thank you for joining us, and of course hope you join us in our next call. Those of you who have further questions, later on, can always email us again at bdsmoder@spme.org. You can reach out to us and, you know, hope to continue the conversation. Above all, I'd like to thank my dear colleagues and friends, Donna and Miriam, for joining me this afternoon. We are excited about the project, and we hope that, again, it will serve as a useful tool, and we will do our best to get the message out there. But I want to thank everybody again and wish everybody a good afternoon. So Miriam, Donna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Asaf. And thanks to all the listeners.
Exactly. We'll be.
Yes.
Thank you all. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.